This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an OTM Podcast Extra. I'm Bob Garfield. It started on a Sunday, October 7th, 2001.
Pentagon sources have confirmed that the U.S. strike has in fact begun, that what we are seeing and hearing in Kabul are in fact the sights and sounds coming from a U.S.-led attack on positions in and around Kabul.
And a short time ago, Ari Fleischer, the president's spokesman, came out in a very terse, direct statement, said we are beginning another front in our war against terrorism so that freedom can prevail over fear. That announcement.
We did not ask for this mission, but we will fulfill it. The name of today's military operation is Enduring Freedom.
Freedom? Not really. But enduring? Oh, yeah.
The air campaign is in its 20th day today. The Pentagon denies the campaign is getting bogged down in Afghanistan. The bombing campaign is causing more civilian casualties and more public protests.
President Bush addressed more than 10,000 soldiers at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, home of the 101st Airborne Division.
We fight now and we will keep on fighting until our victory is complete.
We're on the offensive now instead of the defensive. It's good to get out here on the offense.
This effort must be based on performance. The days of providing a blank check are over.
We are now able to pursue a possible political solution to this long and bloody conflict.
And though premonitions of a Vietnam-like quagmire were voiced early and often, back in 2001, then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld cracked jokes about the very premise.
It looked like nothing was happening. Indeed, it looked like we were in a, all together now, quagmire.
But as Washington Post investigative reporter Craig Whitlock revealed on Monday, a once secret internal history of the war found that the quagmire was and is real. The Afghanistan papers, like the Pentagon papers that 48 years ago laid bare the government's lies about Vietnam, document the efforts of three administrations over nearly two decades to spin expensive, bloody failure into success. Craig, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the lies that the Afghanistan papers make plain, or the central lie that traces to the very beginning of our occupation, the supposed steady progress toward taming the insurgency and building Afghan society. It was sort of never true, and yet that was their story and they were sticking with it.
Well, that's what we tried to do, is contrast what these U.S. officials, NATO officials, Afghan officials, what they were saying in private in these government interviews that had been suppressed, in which they were highly critical about how the war had been going. We contrasted that with public statements from U.S. government officials, from war commanders, from the White House and others. For many years, both under Bush and Obama and somewhat under Trump, the generals would always stick to the same talking points. We're in a tough fight. There are challenges. We don't know how it's going to go exactly, but we're making progress. We're turning the corner. Sometimes they would say we're winning, but it was always some format of that. And that contrasted just 180 degrees from what some of these same people were saying in what we call the Afghanistan papers.
I want to play you just one example. This is Major General Jeffrey Schlosser briefing the press in September 2008 after calling for reinforcements.
What I said was, is at this point in time, we need more resources to continue this endeavor in a timely fashion. We are not losing it, and the enemy cannot win, even given what we have here now. But if we want to proceed onwards and make the improvements that I've laid out, yes, we're going to have to continue to do what I've asked and already said.
I just wanted to see if I understood your answer to Tom's question correctly. When you said you are not losing, are you saying that you are winning?
Look, the truth is that I feel like, we're making some steady progress. It's a slow win, I guess, is probably what we're accomplishing right on over here.
Slowly.
It was a laugh line even a decade ago. But if the press was skeptical, is it fair to say, Craig, that we were institutionally also kind of uncritical in passing these Pollyanna evaluations from the government along?
I don't think journalists were uncritical. As someone who served in the Pentagon press corps for several years, certainly journalists who covered the war were very critical of it. I think the problem is sometimes we would feel obliged to carry along the comments from people like General Schlosser as he said them. Now, usually we would include caveats with that. We would include the context. We would note that at the time General Schlosser was saying this in 2008, that the war was not going well, that U.S. troops were suffering a lot of casualties, that field commanders were asking for reinforcements, that bombings by the Taliban were on the increase. So I think the news media in Afghanistan and covering the Pentagon did a faithful job in chronicling the setbacks and the failures and the problems. What I think, again, is different about these Afghanistan papers is it's the people who were involved in the war, who were responsible for the policy. They're the ones who are finally admitting that things weren't going well, that it was a disaster, and they questioned the very strategy and foundation for why we were there. So finally, we're getting admission from people in charge that all those things they said all along weren't true.
You mentioned the number of Taliban bombings. It seems like one of the complications of this two-decade Big Muddy was that success was a moving target. Were we there to eradicate Al-Qaeda? Were we there to rout the Taliban, to build security infrastructure, to build democratic institutions, to fight corruption, to empower tribal leaders, to build physical infrastructure like roads and schools, modernize the civilization, encourage women's rights, wipe out the opium trade, win hearts and minds of the Afghan populace? Not so much mission creep, but like 10 different missions, some mutually exclusive.
Well, that's right, Bob. And just by you having to lay all those out gives you a sense of exactly how muddled things got. Back in 2001, there was enormous public support for President Bush's decision to send troops to Afghanistan and to retaliate for the 9/11 attacks. There was enormous support from around the world. That mission was pretty clear, to retaliate for 9/11, to try and find Osama bin Laden, and to extinguish the Al-Qaeda threat as best we could. That mission was largely accomplished within 6 months in Afghanistan. The number of Al-Qaeda fighters dwindled down to virtually nothing. Now, many of them were killed, many were captured, and the rest, like bin Laden, fled the country. But we stayed, and that's when things started to go awry. And in the interviews we obtained, what's remarkable, again, is to hear the people who were in charge of the war, in charge of the policy, admit that we lost our way. The mission did start to creep into all these other objectives, which alone or out of context might seem like noble and worthy causes. But that wasn't why we originally went in. And how would we know when we accomplished all these other objectives? They last forever. We're never going to turn Afghanistan into Switzerland. There's no doubt that women are treated very poorly in Afghanistan, but that wasn't why we originally sent troops. And even if that did change into the mission, how long are we going to keep our troops there? I don't think we're going to extinguish the Taliban. They're such a broad-based movement that it's not realistic to say we're going to have a victory against the Taliban.
What you're describing is futility. How many lives and how much treasure have been expended in 19 years tilting at these 9 or 10 windmills?
2,300 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan, more than 20,000 wounded. More than 3,000 U.S. defense contractors have been killed in Afghanistan. About 1,500 NATO and coalition troops have lost their lives. The Afghans have taken by far the biggest brunt of this war. 50,000, 60,000 Afghan security forces have lost their lives. The casualty numbers for the Afghan army and police are so high that the government keeps that number classified. They're worried it would be so demoralizing if they put the true numbers out. The number of Afghan civilians, estimates are a range of 60,000, and then, you know, an unknown number of Taliban and other insurgents. But the best estimates of loss of life that have been put together are that more than 160,000 people have lost their lives since 2001 due to the fighting in Afghanistan.
And all that for only $1 trillion or more.
Or more is probably more accurate. So again, the U.S. government hasn't done a very good job of tracking how much money it has actually spent in the war, and there are probably reasons for that. Again, the best estimates in inflation-adjusted dollars is that we've spent close to $1 trillion on the military operations and trying to rebuild Afghanistan. So that's the money we've spent in Afghanistan for military operations, reconstruction, humanitarian aid, all those kind of things. But those don't take into account the indirect costs, such as VA care for our troops who came back wounded. And since there's more than 20,000 of those, we're going to be caring for those people for many, many years. The cost of the interest we had to take on the debt, the cost of intelligence operations, all these things, it's really hard to add up. But at a minimum, we've spent $1 trillion, but the real costs are going to be many times that.
We didn't just go in there killing people, although we killed a lot of people. We poured a lot of cash into Afghanistan, spread it out among tribal leaders and various kinds of infrastructure programs and government agencies. And it had the effect of taking the smoldering embers of the corrupt culture and turning it into like a 70-alarm blaze.
It did over time. Now, it's important to remember that 18 years of war and things have gone differently at different stages. When we first went in, President Bush was reluctant to spend much money. They were actually aware of the dangers of falling into the trap of being responsible for rebuilding all of Afghanistan. So he tried very hard for a few years not to spend much money there and to get the United Nations and other allies to take on the task of this enormous challenge of trying to build up Afghanistan. That didn't work very well. So after a few years, the Bush administration started spending some more money because they realized that Afghanistan was such a fragile state that the Taliban could come back and take power again. And then when President Obama took office, he took the complete opposite approach of Bush, which was, okay, we didn't do enough to build up this country. We need to get the population on the side of this nascent Afghan government. So we're going to spend out the wazoo, forgive my description, but they spent so much money in such a short period of time that people in these interviews we obtained said they actually did not know how to spend it. They were given orders to spend, spend, spend. People back in Washington didn't care what they were spending it on as long as they could show that they had spent it.
There was one CIA officer you quoted who said his responsibility was to give out $1 million, I think in cash, in just one province every week?
As bad as that sounds, it was actually worse. There was one military officer who said a congressional delegation came to Afghanistan and was asking how it was going. How were they doing with these rebuilding projects? And he said to the congressman, "You're asking me to spend $3 million a day in this Afghan district, in a district the size of a U.S. county. Could you do this at home?" And the congressman said, "No, of course not." And he says, "Well, you're asking me to do this in a place with mud huts and no windows. You know, how can I possibly spend that kind of money?" So that was, in a way, the best description of how nuts it was. And that led to the problem you alluded to earlier, corruption. Afghanistan was never a place that had a clean, well-run government. But now with these billions and billions of dollars flowing in, the opportunities for corruption were unavoidable.
Maybe what's so powerful about your reporting is it reveals not only what we should have known, but actually did know more or less, but as a society, never seemed to lose much sleep over. A faraway war in wherever the hell that is a stand, relatively few American deaths compared to previous conflicts, noble stated goals, and so on. Vietnam divided America. Afghanistan has not. Why?
Well, I think one other big difference between Afghanistan and Vietnam, other than the one, the obvious one you pointed out, which was the death toll and the fact that in Vietnam, Americans were being drafted and sent over there and were dying in very large numbers. One other big difference with Afghanistan is the start of the war, there was enormous public support for it. People understood why we went into Afghanistan because of the 9/11 attacks. We didn't get into Vietnam because anybody in Vietnam attacked us. So I think even though people understood the war perhaps wasn't going well, they were reluctant to make a break with it in terms of popular support because of the memories of 9/11. And there was a reluctance to question perhaps the military assurances that they were making steady progress and you need to trust us on this. And this is a war that is being fought for the right reasons. And I think there's always been a reluctance to make a clean break with that idea.
I want to go back to the process of your reporting. The documents you obtained not from a whistleblower smuggling papers or thumb drives out the back door of the Pentagon, but through the legal process.
Well, that's right. We obtained these the old-fashioned way, which is through a public records request. And this started back in August of 2016 by another old-fashioned news gathering way, which was we got a tip that Michael Flynn, the retired Army general, who is then attracting a lot of attention for his support of Donald Trump and his dislike of Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump will execute the fundamental tenet of peace through strength. And there will be no apologies for our American exceptionalism or leadership standing around the world.
This tip was that General Flynn had given a long interview that had been unpublished to a government agency in which he was railing against the war in Afghanistan.
Never mind, not accomplishing our mission, but the just severity of corruption in our own system, I think is just unbelievable.
And Flynn had been a very key player in the war. He served as chief of military intelligence for the U.S. coalition in Kabul. So we were interested in what he had to say.
Is this a classified?
Yes, it is.
So one piece, is that on?
You can turn that off.
Yeah.
Who was doing the interviewing? Who was he telling this to?
There is an obscure government agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. This agency does things like inspector generals do. They look for fraud and waste and whistleblowers and people who can track misuse of taxpayer dollars. But this agency had done a special project starting in 2014, which was a little bit outside their usual remit, which was to try and understand mistakes made in Afghanistan from a policy standpoint. We heard that they had done an interview with General Flynn. We had heard it was unclassified, even though they hadn't published it or released it. So we went right to the front door and knocked and asked the agency if we could have a copy of what General Flynn had said. And at first, we thought this was a straightforward request and they would respond maybe a few days, maybe a couple weeks. It started to drag out pretty quickly. We filed a Freedom of Information Act request, which requires them to make an official finding. And long story short, it took a long time, many weeks, many months. We had to file a lawsuit, and finally we obtained it. But it took a long time.
3 years, 1,000+ days. Were you being stonewalled by this agency? Were you being slow-rolled? Was there a cover-up in progress?
I don't want to use the word cover-up, but slow-rolled and stonewalled, absolutely. There's no question. This was the bureaucratic art of stonewalling and slow rolling. We had asked for these documents. They're not classified. After we asked for them under the Freedom of Information Act request, then this agency said, oh, well, we need to send it to other government agencies like the State Department, Defense Department, just to make sure none of these people happen to blurt out anything classified. So that took more months, and we had to file a second lawsuit. And the fact of the matter is, after 3+ years, we still don't have everything. Our second lawsuit is still pending before a judge, where we've asked the judge to compel the inspector general to release all of the names of the people who were interviewed. We only have a quarter of them, to release all of the names and all of the redactions they've made. We published what we had because the things people said were so strong, so compelling, so startling, we didn't want to sit on it. But part of me did want to wait. I was hoping the judge would give us a ruling pretty quickly, and then we could publish all of these things all of these people said and identify them by name and what their job were, because I think that's really important from an accountability perspective, who these people were. We know some of them worked in the White House. Some of them were in the field. You know, that's a big distinction. If somebody's slamming Obama or Bush or Trump, it makes a difference if they were somebody who worked for him in the White House as opposed to, you know, some soldier in the field.
And this is one of the great differences between the Afghanistan papers and the Pentagon papers, which compiled and analyzed military reports and statistics and public pronouncements. But in the current case, these researchers went to primary sources who were in the decision chain, and there were like 300 of them. How many of them did you figure out the identities of?
So we figured out about 100 out of 400, rounding them off, so about a quarter. Now, some of them, when they were released under the Freedom of Information Act, they were identified in the documents, maybe about 40. We figured out another 50 or so just by decoding the context of what they said, or we matched up the interview dates with other documents that the inspector general had released publicly. It took a lot of digging, but we thought that was important to know who these people were as best we could. And that job, as I said, is still not done. We still have many more to figure out, and there's more interviews. There's another 200 plus interviews that we've been denied that have been conducted more recently, since 2017. We want to get our hands on those. And again, we're waiting for a ruling from the judge in federal court in Washington, but we're optimistic we'll get those in the coming weeks and months.
I apologize. You caught me underestimating again. Not 300, but 400 interviewees. And the truth that pours from them is jaw-dropping. Can you give me some examples of the unvarnished opinions on the cluster fail that was and is the Afghanistan occupation?
Cluster fail is a good word, and one that people in the military use a version of that a lot. But one of the interviews that jumped out at me right away was with Lieutenant General Douglas Lute, who served as the Afghan war czar, as they called it, in the White House under Bush and Obama. And in his interview, he was very blunt, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but he said, we didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking in Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing. 2,400 lives lost. Were all those lost in vain? So when you see the Afghan war czar in such almost heartrending terms questioning the premise of the war and admitting that the U.S. government didn't know what it was doing, lacked a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, that grabs your attention. And certainly he was one of the stronger ones, but there were others. There was another White House official, a Navy SEAL named Jeffrey Eggers, who again served both Bush and Obama and was the National Security Council director for Afghanistan under Obama. And he was talking about the cost of the war. And he says, what did we get for $1 trillion? He said, when Osama bin Laden was killed, I thought he must be laughing in his watery grave over how much money we spent. And if I could say a word about bin Laden, people forget when the 9/11 attacks happened, from bin Laden's perspective, what he wanted was for the U.S. to get drawn into a long-running war in Afghanistan that would bankrupt the treasury or at least cost us an enormous amount of money, just like what happened to the Soviet Union. So I think Jeffrey Eggers, when he said that bin Laden was laughing in his watery grave, I don't think it's hyperbole.
I'm amazed at how forthcoming Eggers and other officials were with the inspector general's investigators. I'm amazed they weren't more guarded, more self-protective. And I am really amazed that none of this stuff leaked. I mean, it isn't as if the inspector general didn't know what he had. In fact, his name is John Sopko. When he finally spoke publicly, he was, you know, not coy about his team's findings.
The problems we identified in Afghanistan really started here in the United States.
Right.
And that's what we've been identifying, a broken procurement, broken contracting, broken personnel system. And, you know, I think you probably know him better than anyone because you read all the interviews.
How did it stay under wraps for so long?
It wasn't for lack of effort that it didn't leak. I tried very hard to get people to leak these things to me. You know, I'm a reporter, and I tried my best to work sources who worked at this agency or who maybe were familiar with the interviews or might be able to share copies with us. And it was hard, and people didn't want to do it, and it was a little unclear if they didn't have access or they were afraid. And I think there was a lot of fear that the government or the inspector general specifically might come after them and launch a leak investigation. That's something that's become much more common under Obama and Trump. And, you know, well-meaning government officials who have felt the need to leak information of real public importance are very scared to do that. They're scared they'll end up in prison. So that thwarted us from being able to get these a lot sooner. Now, as to why the inspector general sat on them and was able to suppress them, that's a really good question. I've asked him that in an interview we did. And he, of course, denied that they intentionally sat on these things. And he says, well, maybe it'll come out in a report someday. But, you know, it wasn't a very persuasive answer. I mean, they knew they had this material. I think they just figured it was so explosive they couldn't release it. The irony here, too, is that it's hard to believe how direct and blunt and honest these people were in these interviews. Well, the reason many of them were so open and honest and forthright is simply because they never thought they would be quoted publicly. There was sort of an assumption or a tacit deal with the inspector general that if they spoke openly, they wouldn't be identified, that in Washington, people, if they're going to put their name on what they said, they generally aren't very honest and forthcoming. It's only when they can speak anonymously that they tell the truth. In this case, we were able to figure out many of who these people were, and we're still fighting for the rest.
Apart from the inspector general's materials, you also got snowflakes. Tell me about snowflakes.
So snowflakes is a term at the Pentagon for memos dictated by Donald Rumsfeld when he was the defense secretary. And, you know, Rumsfeld is a bit of an old-fashioned executive back in the early 2000s. He was known for standing at a desk and he was blunt in his dealings with his subordinates. But he didn't use email. He would dictate brief memos to a staff person, and they were blunt and they were brusque and they were often just a couple of sentences. He was essentially barking out orders in these memos. And at the Pentagon, they became known as snowflakes. You know, imagine thousands of pieces of paper settling on your desk. And Rumsfeld literally dictated more than 70,000 of these snowflakes during his time in office. He published a book back in 2011, in which he revealed for the first time the existence of these snowflakes publicly. He quoted his own memos, his own snowflakes in his book, and he was kind of proud about it. He posted several hundred of them online. Scholars and national security historians, this lit a fire under them. They were like, how many of these snowflakes are there? We're dying to get our hands on these things. The Pentagon wouldn't release them. So a group called the National Security Archive, a small nonprofit group based at George Washington University, filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Pentagon in 2017 and has been forcing the Pentagon to release them in batches, all 70,000 or so of these snowflakes. The National Security Archive was kind enough to share their haul of snowflakes with the Washington Post. And we searched through them for all the ones related to Afghanistan. And we've published a couple hundred of them on our website as part of the series.
And give me the highlights.
So my top two favorite, they're kind of mind-blowing because Rumsfeld had this real talent for getting right to the point. There was one in March 2002, so just 6 months into the war, and he sends a snowflake, which usually were just a couple paragraphs. He sent one to several generals and policy aides, and he says, we need to find a policy to stabilize Afghanistan so we can get our troops out of there. Otherwise, we're never going to get out of Afghanistan. And the last line of the snowflake was one word. It said, help, exclamation point. So even back in March of 2002, back when Rumsfeld and the Bush White House were beating their chests over how well the war was going, behind the scenes, Rumsfeld is worried the U.S. military was never going to be able to withdraw. And of course, he was right. He was right to be worried, but this was something they weren't telling to the public. My other favorite snowflake, as it were, it's very disturbing in some ways, came a year later. Rumsfeld had a meeting with President Bush in the Oval Office, and he had gone up to Bush and said, you know, President Bush, I'm trying to set up a meeting for you with Tommy Franks, who's our general in charge of the whole Middle East, and Dan McNeil. And according to Rumsfeld's memo, the president turned to Rumsfeld and said, who's General McNeil? And Rumsfeld said, well, sir, he's the general in charge of the war in Afghanistan. And Bush responded, well, I don't need to meet with him. And he walked off. And that was Rumsfeld's account of it. So again, here they are 18 months into the war in Afghanistan, and Rumsfeld's trying to get President Bush to meet with the commander of all U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and Bush didn't even know who that general was, and beyond that, saw no need to sit down with him, that he was completely focused on the forthcoming war in Iraq.
We've talked about the parallels between the Afghanistan papers and the Pentagon papers, and they're obvious. So is the irony, because the project was titled Lessons Learned. And it certainly makes clear that in the 40 years between Vietnam and Afghanistan, no lessons were learned. Or does it? Is the comparison too glib and reductive? Are there new lessons here?
There are new lessons, but I think you're right. A lot of lessons from Vietnam weren't learned, and that comes through loud and clear in the interviews we obtained. Now, a double irony here is that the Inspector General did publish several reports from its lessons learned program in Afghanistan, focusing on things like corruption and the production of narcotics and establishing an Afghan army. And these reports are very thick, very detailed, a couple hundred pages each, you know, real door stoppers. Nobody reads them. They're written in a way that make you fall asleep. And they left out all the good stuff people were saying in these interviews, you know, all the quotations, all the remarks about what a failure the war was and going into real detail about it. They sanitized all that. And the public reports were just kind of compilations of statistics and summaries. And in a way, the Inspector General didn't learn its own lesson, which was we need to be forthcoming with the truth. We shouldn't hold back. We should level with the American people about what's really going on instead of trying to whitewash it.
I can hardly believe I'm about to ask the question I'm about to ask, but one thing I noticed in your stories is that of the three presidential administrations with responsibility for the war in Afghanistan, the most straightforward may be the present one. Maybe not coherent or consistent, but maybe more prepared to call a spade a spade. Am I crazy?
Well, no, you're not crazy. Now, as with everything with President Trump, things aren't always so consistent. But I think there's no question that President Trump, during the presidential campaign and since he's gotten in office, he's made clear he wants to end the war in Afghanistan. He wants to get out. Now, he hasn't been able to do that. And in fact, he's increased the number of troops since President Obama left. The air war has really intensified to levels we haven't seen since the height of the surge in Afghanistan under Obama. So the war has picked up on Trump's watch. At the same time, he's sent diplomats to negotiate directly with the Taliban for the first time. And there is no question he's trying to negotiate a deal with the Taliban to at least curtail the fighting and withdraw as many troops as he can get out of there.
Greg, one last thing. Right at the outset, I called your story monumental. It will certainly be historic, but it broke on Monday. By Tuesday, it had already disappeared from the aggregation homepages like Google News. I mean, vanished. Now, I'd say it was swamped by impeachment, but the Peloton exercise bike commercial kerfuffle after 2 weeks was still front and center. What is happening?
Well, actually, to be honest, in the reality of the present day news cycles and short attention spans, I was surprised by how much of a chord our publication of these articles did seem to strike with readers. Now, will people tune out? Will they move on to the next shiny thing in a day? You know, yeah, I'm sure that's inevitable. But I think people won't forget this. I think this was a particular moment in time when people's perceptions of the war, which were always skeptical of what was going on in Afghanistan, I think this reinforced a lot of people's suspicions. And I think it will be hard for the public. I would think it would be very difficult for anyone in Washington to look at the war the same way and cast it in the same terms as they did prior to these Afghanistan papers coming to light.
Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest.
Greg Whitlock is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. This has been an OTM Podcast Extra. On the big show this week, we take a deep dive on a path not taken on abortion rights. Meantime, to subscribe to our newsletter, check out onthemedia.org. I'm Bob Garfield.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.